The Helly Kesser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast's always available online at HellyKesserJane.com. What's the thing with you and history?
History is just not a bunch of dates and facts you memorize. History is a selection process, and it doesn't just choose a person in a moment and ram them together. History chooses every single one of us every single day. And the only question is, do you hear the call? And to me, that's why I love history, because it's proof of our greatest achievements and our worst failures. It's proof that we are all amazing and awful, that we're all generous and selfish, that we're all, you know, terrified but incredibly brave. And all of us, you know, many of us all on the same day.
History, proof of our greatest achievements and of our worst failures. The words of a genius and one of the great students of history, Brad Meltzer, out with a brand new historical thriller, The President's Shadow, and here with me today on the Helly Kesser Jane Show. Also joining me at my table, the equally brilliant and prolific author and historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Hi, and welcome to the Helly Kesser Jane Show. I am Helly Kesser Jane. My guests will join me in a moment. But first, the Helly Kesser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Helly Kesser Jane Show. And remember, The Helly Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HellyKesserJane.com and a host of venues including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and Blog Talk Radio. Google us and you will find us. Brad Meltzer is the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Inner Circle, The Book of Fate, and seven other bestselling thrillers. In addition to his fiction, he is one of the only authors to ever have books on the bestseller list for nonfiction, advice, children's books, and even graphic books, for which he won the prestigious Eisner. Meltzer is also the host of Brad Meltzer's Lost History on H2 and Brad Meltzer's Decoded on the History Channel. The Hollywood Reporter recently put him on their list of Hollywood's 25 most powerful authors. Now Meltzer returns to the thrillers, The House That I Built With My Own Two Hands, as he calls them, with the release of The President's Shadow, the third chapter following archivist Beecher White and the Culper Ring, a secret society created by George Washington to clandestinely steer the course of history. In yet another taut historical political conspiracy, a quick-paced page-turner that only Brad Meltzer can write, The President's Shadow begins in the White House Rose Garden with the discovery of a severed arm with a mysterious memento clutched in its fist by the First Lady. Let's talk. So, Brad, so good to have you back on the show, first of all, and so good to have Beecher White back with all you do.
I appreciate that.
It's true. It's true. With all you do, you are the jack of all trades, by the way. That's what I've decided you are. I've never seen anybody have a career like yours in my whole entire life. But amongst all of it, you do, right? Is writing thrillers what thrills you most?
Listen, I love doing a TV show for the History Channel. I love doing the kids' books that I do for my own kids, I'm Amelia Earhart and I'm Abraham Lincoln. But I will say there's just nothing like the thrillers, because that's the house I build with my own hands. I mean, I have an editor who's making sure I don't mess it up too badly, but really I stare at a blank page and have to start from nothing.
Yeah, and that's a thrill for you. I get that. It's like a blank canvas, right? And then you just get to do whatever you want with it.
There's nothing like sitting down, and there's nothing more terrifying than looking at a blank page and saying, I'm going to turn these into 400 pages of something that's going to entertain you during a great moment, a beach moment, you know, people who write me from when they're in the hospital or when their kids are being born and they're waiting there. And it's just unbelievable to share those moments with people. And it comes out of nowhere but my imagination.
Fun place to play, isn't that? What got you going on The President's Shadow?
It was really, usually I can pinpoint where an idea comes from. This one was a simple one. It's the First Lady in the White House Rose Garden. And it's 5 o'clock in the morning. She just wants, every First Lady I've ever met, they just want normalcy, Ellie. They just want a moment of calm. And so she's gardening. She puts her hands into the dirt of the rose garden. She smells the mulch. And in that dirt, she finds a severed arm. And she has no idea how it got there, has no idea how it got past security. She certainly doesn't know that in the fist of that arm is a puzzle that's going to have to be solved. But I wake up with that, and I'm like, I got the idea. But you know me well enough and long enough that, to me, the real fun comes when I take that fictional idea that I just made up, and I go to the Secret Service in real life, and I say, listen, here's my idea for this book. Here's what happens in the Rose Garden. If you were really investigating a severed arm, what would you do? And the Secret Service said to me, well, the first thing I would do is I would redecorate a room in the White House. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, think about it this way. They said, if I put some wallpaper on one wall and take some paint off another wall, now I can get the first family out of the White House. I can move them across the street for 3 days while we renovate. And then the press has no idea what I'm up to, and I can investigate without anyone being the wiser. And I said, that sounds like something you've done before. And he said to me, Brad, think of it this way. Bill Clinton and George Bush and Barack Obama have all renovated rooms while they were president. You wouldn't believe what's been done here in the name of home renovation. And I was like, thank you for chapter 2 and 3 and 4.
It's amazing how these things come together, right? I mean, and sometimes it's just sheer magic. And I'm sure as the historian that you are and going to do research, that sometimes it is magic. You don't expect to find what you're going to find, and then it's what, voila?
Well, you know what? What happens is it depends on what it is. For instance, in the book, there's two things I was obsessed with. I'll give you the first one, and we can talk about the second. But at one point, there's a scene where Beecher walks into Secret Service headquarters. Why? Because I went to Secret Service headquarters. And while I was there, they took me in a back room that's like a little museum. And in that museum, they have, you know, some memorabilia from guns and badges from their most famous cases. And they said to me, you want to hear a really cool story. When the Secret Service, Allie, says, you want to hear a cool story, what's the answer?
Right? Yeah, listen.
Right? Yeah, so I say, of course. They say, here's the story. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, they tell me, used to carry a gun. And I said, that's not true. They said, it is. It was a .38. He sometimes hid it in his briefcase and took it on Air Force One. And I was blown away. I immediately, years ago, I got letters from Bill Clinton saying he liked the books. I got letters from George H.W. Bush. And I basically contacted George H.W. Bush because he's helped me with the last 4 of my books to do research. He's answered questions for me, and I ask a question, and he gives me an answer. This was the first time President Bush asked me a question. He basically was like, tell me more about that Reagan gun thing.
He didn't know, but he did know.
I became obsessed with that, but the scenes you see in the book, when you're reading, and you'll see in Secret Service headquarters, that's not Beecher there. That's me. That's me walking around and seeing things, and what I saw there is now in the president's shadow.
You know, this is funny that you said that because, you know, this is something I wanted to say to you. And you're throwing me off track because I got this whole thing that down, you know, me, got questions to ask you, but you're throwing me off. And this is where I was going to go in a minute. So I'm going to go there now. Right. And it's you. It's about you. I know you, like you said, for quite a while, and I'm, you know, pretty well. It's interesting to me who you are, but who Beecher is, too. Beecher Wise, he's not exactly what most of us think of archivists. He's smart. He's sexy. He's daring. He's exciting. Is he you?
You know, listen, Beecher is definitely obsessed with the arcane and with history. So, yes, on that level, he's me. He's far smarter than I am, right? It's like every fictional character is the writer's dream and also the writer's wish fulfillment. But here's where Beecher is me. And I'm going to tell you this story by way of Abraham Lincoln. And this will make sense after I explain it. One of the things you know I'm obsessed with is Abraham Lincoln's assassination. And we all know John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln. And what we forget is sometimes that there were 8 other co-conspirators who were convicted of the crime. Now, 4 of them were hanged. The other 4 of them actually were sent to life in prison. But here's what really happened to them. They were pulled out of their jail cell in the middle of the night. They were thrown onto a boat. The boat goes heading south toward Florida. It goes past Miami. It goes past Key West, at which point they're like, there's nothing past Key West in it, but there is. And it's still there. The government had, it used to be secret, now it's well known, but the government has an island a few people know about. And on this island, it used to be called Devil's Island, then known as Fort Jefferson, then known as the Dry Tortugas. But on this island is where Abraham Lincoln's killers went. And I became obsessed with it. I went down there because I live in Florida, so I went down to see it. And it's a national park now. I won't ruin the end. The last 100 pages
right.
of The President's Shadow take place on this island, and you'll see what happened to them, and you'll see the hidden room that's on the island where Lincoln's killers were. But I tell you the story because of this. My favorite detail is that on this island was Dr. Samuel Mudd, was one of the killers. And he went there as one of the most hated men in America, killed Abraham Lincoln. But on that island, there was an outbreak of yellow fever at the time. He was a doctor, and he starts helping people. And now he goes from being this awful person that everyone hates to being this hero who saves people's lives. And I'm like, this is an island of transformation. And this is where Beecher was me, is as I started writing this book, it was the first book I was ever writing where my parents were gone. They had died, and now I was like, I need to use this book to get over the death of my parents. That's what I wanted to do. And what I realized as I was writing it, and as I was going, and Beecher was on his journey and looking for his own father in the book, even though it's all fiction, I realized I don't ever want to get over the death of my parents. My parents deserve to be remembered, and as anyone who loses someone knows, when you love someone with your whole heart, there are holes in you. And the only way to fill those holes is you must transform. You must transform. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, this book, this isn't just Beecher's journey. On this island of transformation, in the last 100 pages of this book, this is what my journey is right now. And so in this book, as you get to the end, you'll see exactly what I'm searching for is what Beecher's searching for.
You hear me? There's this long pause. I don't know if they'll cut it out after we finish this, but the long pause is that you get me so engaged just by talking, buddy.
I appreciate it, but listen, that's the truth, right?
I really believe that
you have to pour yourself into a book if you want it to be great. And I said, I'm truly in this one pouring myself into
your
book.
Heart. Yeah, and maybe that's what I was saying to you off air, why I love this book so much. Your heart is so in this book. It's so clear. It's just extraordinary. Listen to me. Whatever you do, children's books, graphic books, fiction, nonfiction, history, of course, is always at the heart of a Brad Meltzer project. But I don't have to tell you that there are many who are bored to tears by history, and then there are those who are possessed by it. Here's my other thing with you. Is it the sleuthing to uncover the past that entices you? A need to understand the past? Or is it that old line that those that cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it? Or what? What's the thing with you in history?
For me, history is just not a bunch of dates and facts you memorize. History is a selection process, and it doesn't just choose a person in a moment and ram them together. History chooses every single one of us every single day. And the only question is, do you hear the call? And to me, that's why I love history, because it's proof of our greatest achievements and our worst failures. It's proof that we are all amazing and awful, that we're all generous and selfish, that we're all, you know, terrified but incredibly brave. And all of us, you know, many of us all on the same day.
Yeah.
So I just love it for that. And you know what I really love? And again, you know me well enough for this. I love a good story. That's what I love.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing to me like a good story. When you hear a story that, you know, one of the ones in here is you'll see that below the White House, there's not just a basement, but there's a floor below that. And you get to go and see one of the rooms in there. Now I'm like, I'm listening. There's another room. You're telling me there's almost as many rooms below the White House as above it? I want to see that. That's just a cool story, a cool place to be.
You could have been a detective,
so, you know,
too.
It's always a little bit of both. It's a little bit of inspiration, and it's a little bit of perspiration.
That I'm sure of. And then there's this. There's all this great intrigue and unveiling of history that most of us don't know. There's a passage in here I want to ask you about. It fascinated me, and it also made me laugh. Maybe it's why one of the ones that stay there. It sounds so ridiculous. Can it be true that the Russians during the Cold War?
It's a true story.
This is true. Tell the audience.
My story. It's so awesome.
I love this story. Tell this one.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite things someone told me. I was like, I need to use this. So this is true. It's in the book. It's all fiction, right? President Shadow's fiction. But this part, when the President of the United States tells this story, it's true, is that during the Cold War, the Russians had their nuclear arsenal, of course, had many bullseyes of where they were going to hit and what they had it aimed at. But one of the true bullseyes was at the Pentagon, at a little spot in the Pentagon at the center, a little shack called the Courtyard Cafe. And the reason why the Russians had their arsenal aimed there at directly at this cafe is because they would see big generals always going in the cafe and coming out, in the cafe and coming out day after day. So they knew, you know, that this must be a secret location that goes down underground, because all these generals are going in there. And so they made the nuclear arsenal point to there. Years later, when we found out that's what they were aiming at, we actually revealed that the reason all the generals were going in the Courtyard Cafe is simply because they had the best hot dogs and coffee at the Pentagon. It was just a restaurant. And it was, and I just love that. Like, you're telling me that the bullseye that the Russians had to annihilate us was basically not a secret lair, but it was the cool place to get coffee. And I just love that detail. I said, I got to put that in the book.
Yeah, no, that's so you. That is just so you to take that
and
little.
But you know when you read that.
Right.
Right? I can make up whatever I want. That's my job. But you know when you read that, that you go, there's something real here.
Yeah.
Something hits you in the chest and goes, that just is not something someone makes up.
It says so much on so many levels. Think about it, right? I mean, it's a great story. There are so many of those great stories in there. I mean, and one thing that you do in this book, which was a little bit unnerving, I thought, was that you reveal some of the government's involvement in some seriously shocking research. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So obviously, the end of the book, you'll see some government experiments that are taking place. And of course, I made those up. But what I didn't do, as I was researching them, I thought I was making everything up. And then I went to these social scientists and said, hey, can you help me just research what kind of experiment we should do? And what I found is not everything was entirely made up. I, of course, made it worse and made it more, you know, that it matched what I was doing in the plot. But basically, she's like, you have no idea what's been done by the government in the name of science. And I found, you know, and listen, some of these things we know about, from the Tuskegee Airmen, getting syphilis, to all these amazing other things that are just horrible and amazing in the very worst way. They're just shocking. And I just kept finding, you know, I said, what if you had, and I don't want to ruin the end of the book, but what if you had this kind of experiment? She said, they had that kind of experiment. And that's when you go, I'm making that up, and someone's telling you, you didn't really entirely. And that's really one of those terrifying days for a novelist.
Do you think they still do that? Did you go on, want to go and look
no,
to see?
No, I don't. I feel like, do I think other governments do? Yeah, I really
do. Oh, for sure there, yeah.
But I know, I think there are things we don't, listen, if you say right now, you know, whatever it might be, there's always going to be science experiments that are done. But, you know, I think the harder part today is keeping those things quiet. And it's a different world we live in today. You see how many secrets come out every day because people can just go to their computer and publish them without anyone knowing. But there's always going to be more secrets. But do I think that they're doing things like that? I don't.
Speaking of the world being different today, this is the first book you've come out with, because you did go through all that with losing your parents for what, a couple of years? Talk to me. Did it change how you approach writing now? Or the way a story can evolve today, knowing the way the world works and the way we are and how data gets out there? You know, it's a different world than it was even 2 years ago. Affect a writer?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, I think what I do, I hope I do, is I hope I'm more honest as a writer. I can't say I'm a better writer than I used to be, but I hope I'm, and I feel like I'm a more honest writer. Like when we first, well, before we met, but in my first two books, when I would do interviews, they'd say, how you doing, Brad? And I'd say, everything's great. I sounded like a rookie baseball player on a team. You know, I'm just happy to be here. I'm going to take it one day at a time. And eventually I realized, you know what? It's okay to say things are hard. It's okay to say it's hard to write these books. It's okay to say my parents died. And I think it really was when my mom passed that I said, you know, if you're going to put out the good, you can share the bad. And what was amazing to me on our Facebook pages and on Twitter is how many readers responded to that and were there for me. In fact, I love this story. A couple weeks ago, I opened up our mail, and people know I had said that my mom used to love to shop at Marshall's. And when we grew up, we didn't have a lot of money, so my mom loved Marshall's. It was her favorite store. And the first time that I hit the bestseller list in the number one spot, I called my mom, and I told her, and I said, where are you? And she said, I'm at Marshall's. And I was laughing. I'm like, of course you are. I'm here, you know, you're buying a regular sock today. And one of our readers recently, just a couple weeks ago, sent me a card that said, I was just thinking of your mom, and I was in Marshall's, and here's a $10 gift card to Marshall's in your mom's honor.
Ugh.
And I just was like, that was one of the nicest things anyone's ever done for me. And obviously, you know, we'll donate the Marshall thing to someone, but it was, you know, it was amazing to me as a writer when you put out your honest feelings, how much more you can get back. And I think when you read The President's Shadow, that's what Beecher's doing. He's just very, very honest about who he is and what he wants.
He's a mensch, and so are you, but I can say that.
I appreciate that.
It's true, it's true, it's true. Mount Weather. Talk to me about Mount Weather. You know, I lived in Washington for a while, and we used to go play at Mount Weather.
And you used to play at Mount Weather?
Well, I'll tell you the story. Everybody knew. You know, if you lived in that area.
No, if you live there, you know what's there.
You know what's there. And, you know, there was a plane crash there, and so there's all this folklore around the plane crash that was there. And, you know, everybody's trying to figure out whether there was a government facility there, because you can't see it no matter what. So, yeah, it's part of the Washington experience. Talk to me.
Yeah, listen, so Mount Weather used to be this top secret place where we used to, use as a safe house, really, for the government in case anything went wrong. We had to hide the president, or we had to, go and have a communications breakdown. This is where people would go. And then, as you know, everyone found out about it. And they just said, okay, we can't use this as a hiding spot if everyone knows your hiding spot. But what people didn't realize is that after 9/11, the government actually started pouring millions of dollars into Mount Weather and started rebuilding it. And I actually even found out what building the president to keep him in. I changed that, of course, for the book, when I was writing the book, because there are some things that just should not be revealed.
Right.
But people that live there now know about it, but it's the place where, during the State of the Union, it's one of the places where we always leave, the cabinet is fully together, president, vice president, speaker of the House, all the Supreme Court and everybody in the cabinet, we leave one cabinet member behind, and Mount Weather is sometimes the place where they take that person. And, I just love that detail as I was researching. I'm like, you tell me that there's a bat cave for the United States of America? I want to know where the bat cave is.
Right, exactly. Here's another...
And it's really, it's a city now, but there's as much underground as there is above it.
Yeah, I would love to go there now, after I read this book again. And it comes back to my mind. I want to go and play there. You have to know. Have you been over there at all?
It's one of the places I haven't been. Ones, obviously, that I had to do from someone. But the person that gave it to me, I trust implicitly. And so it was, I really do feel like...
It's a beautifully rural. Yeah, it's a beautifully rural area. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah.
And it's very special. Here's something else that's in the book. The personal effects of what the president's carry? How'd you find that?
A fun one. So while we talk about the gun that Reagan used to carry.
Right.
And one of the things that I became obsessed with was, what do the other presidents carry then? And I went to former President Bush and I said, what did Reagan carry? If Reagan carried a gun, what'd you carry, sir? You must have something cool too. I found out that George Bush Sr. used to carry with him while he was president in his pocket just his driver's license. That was it. Which is amazing, because the Secret Service, when your president doesn't let you drive.
Right.
But there he was carrying that. And I was like, are you worried about going to a bar and being carded? Like, why would you do that? Bill Clinton used to carry a billfold, and it would have money and credit cards, but also a picture of Chelsea, a picture of Hillary, and then also would have a prayer. They would, I guess, to be mindful of things. George W. Bush used to carry a badge of a fallen Port Authority police officer who died in 9/11. He used to carry that badge with him to honor him, which, again, gotta give respect to that. And also gotta respect President Obama carries a BlackBerry, but also all the knickknacks and military coins and things people give him, he has some of them he still just keeps with him. He could easily give them to his aide and forget about them, and who cares about these presents, but he keeps them. You gotta respect that. And the one thing that every president also carries is they all carry a little card that you can crack open and has all the nuclear codes on it. And that's a really cool thing to carry.
That is phenomenal information, right? Amazing, because I didn't know that.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah, seriously, I like that too. George H.W. Bush, how's he doing?
He looked good. So about a week and a half ago, I got invited to Barbara Bush's 90th birthday party.
Saw that. I'm so pea green with envy.
It was incredible. What they do is it was a bipartisan event to raise money for literacy. And she raised, I think, something like $17 million. God bless her, right? But they said that Mrs. Bush and her staff, had picked out four authors to come and entertain. And I was like, wow, who are you getting? And they said, dummy, it's you.
Love it.
So I went to Kennebunkport. At one point, I was there in these two kind of small rooms, just regular, normal-sized rooms. It wasn't like a ballroom or anything. And it's George Bush and Barbara Bush and Laura Bush and W and Jeb Bush and my wife and myself. My wife looked at me and said, at what point did your life become Forrest Gump? And it was just one of those moments you can't, of course, take it seriously, but it was an amazing, amazing experience.
That's gorgeous.
And just an honor to be there. And President Bush, to answer your question, he looked great. And I think, listen, Mrs. Bush looks incredible. But they're 90 and, I think, 93. I mean,
right.
this is not even 80 anymore.
Right, right. I love it. I love it. And I can think of nobody who deserves it better than you, buddy, to have that kind of accolade. So there you go.
Please.
Listen, it's true. So listen to what I'm going to tell you. I am picturing Brad Meltzer as a young boy. First growing up in Brooklyn and then South Florida. Were you the kid who read the Hardy Boys into the wee hours of the night with your flashlight beneath the covers? Or were you the kid who spent a lot of time, playing in the school library looking for stuff? Who was Brad Meltzer the boy?
I did have all the Hardy Boys, but I was much more likely to be reading Agatha Christie.
Really?
That was what I was reading. I remember we didn't have a lot of money, but we had my grandmother's library card, and I had a library card. And I remember reading Agatha Christie's, the first book I read of hers was called Murder at the Vicarage. And to this day, I don't know what a vicarage is. I don't want to know. I don't want anyone to tell me what it is. But I just remember opening that book, and somewhere in there was a dead body. and going, oh my gosh, there's a dead body. And then I asked myself that question that I've been asking myself basically ever since, which is, who done it? And that, you know, that was a massive, massive impact on me. But I loved, of course, I loved reading. I read Judy Blume, and I read anything I could get my hands on. But mostly I was reading comic books. I loved comic books.
And still do.
And comic books were just the amazing thing for me. Because to me, the most important part of the story is not Superman. The most important part of the story is Clark Kent. And why? Because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be boring and ordinary and wish we'd do something incredibly beyond ourselves. And I think that's what, you know, even in everything I do now, is it really does focus on that power of an ordinary person and their ability to change the world. And it's why I started our kids book series. Now, you know, I'm Amelia Earhart and I'm Abraham Lincoln. I was tired of my own kids looking at reality TV show stars and thinking that's a hero. And, you know, I knew what I read when I was little. I wanted to give them something just as good. So I started writing I'm Amelia Earhart, I am Abraham Lincoln, I am Rosa Parks, I am Albert Einstein. We did I am Jackie Robinson, and in 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks comes out, Haley, we do I am Lucille Ball.
I saw that. I just had Lucy Arnaz on the show last week, by the way. I was laughing my head off when I read that.
I did.
She's delicious. She's the best. She is so funny. It's just unbelievable. She's so talented, too. I mean, she's a great girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've known each other a long time.
You know, they read the book for us, which was great, the people that managed the estate. And what I love, though, is people said, why are you doing Lucille Ball as a hero? And I said, I want my daughter to have an entertainment hero she can look up to who isn't just famous for being thin and pretty.
Right.
I want someone, you know, I want, Lucille Ball to me stands not just for the fact that it's okay to be different, but that it's spectacular to be different.
What a wealth.
And that indeed, that's what she is. She's different than everybody else. She's the first woman to run her own studio. She produces Star Trek and Mission Impossible television shows. And I love that for my daughter. So we do I Am Lucille Ball in 2.5 weeks on July 14th. In September, we do I Am Helen Keller. And wait till you see that book. I mean, I think I Am Abraham Lincoln may be one of my favorites we did, but I Am Helen Keller has real Braille in the book. So when you get to it and they touch the dots, it says, this is my name. My name's Helen. What's your name? And on the next page, it has the entire Braille alphabet so they can feel their way. And it's just remarkable.
Unbelievable. You are such a character. Do you ever sleep?
That is my problem these days. I definitely could use some sleep, I think.
Okay. I'm going to throw out some words. Mystery, secret, the word, code, conspiracy. Is that like good sex for you?
Listen, there are a few things that are as good as good sex. But that is, when you say the words, I'm definitely like, oh, I want to hear. I want in. Like, yeah, no
right.
question.
Right.
Those are ones that get me going. Because you know what it is? I realize in my life that the moment you tell me that I've done something, I can do it again, I'm not interested. The moment you tell me I can't have it, I want it.
Boy, I can
and
relate to that.
It's a mystery, and you say I can't have it, and you can't know, I want it.
You are listening to the Haley Kasser Change Show, the podcast, always available online at HaleyKasserChange.com.
So I'm going to go back to Agatha Christie for a second. Do you start at the end first? Do you have your ending before you start?
I always know who done it.
You do?
I always know the bad guy.
Interesting.
I knew how that arm got there. I may twist some details, twist some facts. Things may, of course, will change and allegiances will change and this person will be helping that person, but I know the ending. And that's basically, and then I know the first 50 pages and I write those 50 and then I basically make up the next 50 or 100 and outline those and then I write those. And over the course of the year and a half, it's a, you know, 6 months of research, an hour and a year and a half of writing, obviously things change and morph, but I do need to know where I'm going. I need to know what that end point is.
So it's the maze for you that's really exciting.
Of it is the spontaneity of twisting and turning it. I once wrote a book where I outlined the entire book and just wrote it, and it was no fun.
Right.
Because it was just playing like connect the dots. It was just, I knew what the dots were, I knew the shape, and what's the fun of that? But when you tell me that I don't know what it is and I got to figure it out, then again, it becomes its own puzzle.
Oh, that's fascinating. So, Brad Meltzer, this is what I'm going to say to you. History, okay? Your father lost his job and had less than $2,000 in his pocket, and that's what led the family to relocate to South Florida. Thus, poverty is something you know about, right? Your grandfather would recite a 4-sentence story about Batman to you as a child, your lesson in storytelling and primer for the use of that imagination we talked about earlier. You're the first in your family to earn a college degree, right? And a law degree to boot, which I never knew. I didn't know that you'd been a lawyer. In 1994, you co-wrote the original swearing-in oath that is taken by AmeriCorps members and has been delivered by Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. In 1996, this is your life, right? In 1996, you created one of the earliest author websites for your first published novel, The Tenth Justice. In September 2006, you participated in a work group along with the CIA, the FBI, various psychologists, and Department of Homeland Security intelligence staff to brainstorm new ways that terrorists might attack the U.S. And of course, your history includes successful writer, your significant contributions to TV, father, husband. Hopefully, you have a long way still to go. I hope so. I really, really, really do. But here's what I have to say to you. How do you want history to remember Brad Meltzer?
Now you're asking good questions that are really hard questions, too. the one thing I've learned is you don't write your own history. How you're remembered. What you get to do is you get to live your life. And to me, if you live a good life and you go help people and you go say thank you, that's not just how you live a good life, that's how you live forever. And so to me, I can have all the dreams I want of how I'm remembered, but I just hope people remember me as a nice person who helped people. That's it. That's all any of us can hope for.
I've been speaking with Brad Meltzer, author of The President's Shadow, by way of Grand Central Publishing. Looking for a great read? This is it. For more information about Brad and his many projects, visit him on Facebook at Brad Meltzer and on Twitter at Brad Meltzer and at his website at bradmeltzer.com. Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Team of Rivals, the Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, are only some of the books that Pulitzer Prize-winning American biographer, historian, political commentator, and baseball enthusiast Doris Kearns Goodwin has given to the world. A frequent guest commentator on Meet the Press, as well as a regular guest on Charlie Rose, appearing a total of over 40 times since 1994, Doris Kearns Goodwin has also made appearances on NBC, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, CNN, The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and The Colbert Report. But Doris Kearns Goodwin is not one to rest on her laurels. Her latest contribution to historical writing is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and The Golden Age of Journalism. Welcome to The Hallie Castor Jane Show, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Hi, Doris. Nice to have you here.
I am very glad to be with you. So you and I share something in common. I have to tell you the story. You were the first woman journalist to enter the Red Sox locker room, and I was the first young girl to enter the New York Yankees locker room. True story. And look what happened to you. Look what happened to you, though. Me, I'm just a little talk show host. You're a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. That doesn't seem fair to me. I was a kid. They took me to the stadium because my dad was friendly with a lot of players, and they didn't know what to do with me. My dad had child duty that day, and they put me in with the caveat that I never tell anybody I was there, and today I'm telling on the Hallie Castor Jane Show the first time that I actually went in there.
What a memory, though.
Isn't that hysterical?
Never forget, I am sure.
Oh, no, absolutely, no way. But look at you now. You become a historian. But the way you did it has to do with the Boston Red Sox and your dad. Tell us about that. I love
There's
that.
There's no question that my love of history began with my father's love of baseball. So originally, we grew up in New York. We were Brooklyn Dodger fans. My father taught me that mysterious art of keeping score while listening to baseball games so I could record for him the history of that afternoon's Brooklyn Dodger game. When he came home, I would then in excruciating detail recount every play of every inning, and he loved it, and I began to think, wow, this is so exciting. If history, even if it's only 5 hours old, can keep my father's attention, there must be something magic about history. So all my life, history and baseball have been intertwined, and you're right. I mean, I happened to be at the Red Sox then. I later became a Red Sox fan when the L.A. Dodgers were formed, abandoning us from Brooklyn. And I was at a Red Sox spring training game, and the order came down from Major League Baseball, because somebody had sued on Sports Illustrated's behalf, that women had to go in the locker room. So they just said, well, you're sitting here, go in.
So it's a Trivial Pursuit question in New England, who was the first woman into the Red Sox, but maybe the first woman journalist, who knows, another little girl might have been in there, like you, with a story that she hasn't told.
You never know, you just never know, but it's such a great story. This is interesting about you. There aren't a whole lot of women or well-known women historians. Are you surprised at your acceptance and your success? You really are groundbreaking that way.
Well, the issue to me is that the woman who was my mentor, who I only met later in my life, was Barbara Tuchman. I mean, when I was a college student, she wrote Guns of August, still one of the most extraordinary history books I've ever read. And it was about military history, which seemed even greater that a woman could master that. And it's surprising to me. I would think, and I think it's going to happen much more and more, history seems like a natural subject for women because it's about relationships. At least the way I write about it, it's always about these people and their relationships with one another. And if you can make them come alive, then all the policies and the programs of the era can be understood through them. And it seems that should be a natural thing for women to be able to write about. So my guess is, as more and more women are going to college and graduate school, as we're seeing now, majorities, that they're going to be popping up a lot more women historians.
And I think there's something else to this. First of all, let me say this. You have a lot of men around you. You have the Boston Red Sox. You've lived with Lyndon Johnson, the Kennedy men, Franklin Roosevelt, Abe Lincoln, not to mention your husband, Richard. And you have, what, three sons, I think, right?
Yes, indeed.
And now you take on two new large historical male figures in Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft in the latest wonderful, wonderful book published, by the way, by Simon & Schuster, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. But you are, as we've just noted, a woman. And I wonder if really, and I don't mean this to be a sexist question, but I think it is, there is a certain reality to it, is being a woman helpful to you and how you come to understand these men that you so brilliantly write about?
No, I'd like to believe that in some ways it is. I mean, I think that it all began with the kind of empathy I felt for Lyndon Johnson when I was 24 years old and accompanied him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs, saw how sad he was knowing his own legacy had been cut in two. And I began to make a pledge to myself, if I wrote about these people, I would at least try and understand them from the inside out. And then in each of these books, besides the men, because I have made a career out of dead presidents, which means mostly men, there are these female figures. So in the new book, I've got Edith Roosevelt, who makes a choice at that time in her life that she wants to be mainly a companion and a lover and a mother for her family. She had come from a disordered background, had lost her home as a little girl when her father went bankrupt. So what she wants for her own life is to give a sanctuary and a home to her beloved husband. Theodore has no interest in being a public first lady, said, I'm a private person. You know, women should appear in news only when they get married and buried. And then in contrast, you have another woman making a different choice in Nellie Taft, who from the time she was young dreamed of having a more expansive life, wanted to be a teacher, thought she wouldn't marry so that her ambitions could be met. She meets young Will Taft, who adores her and gives her the space to really become his partner. She's the one who loves politics more than he. She's the one who becomes almost his campaign manager and his speechwriter. And then he gets into politics in part because of her. And she becomes a very active first lady when she first gets in, worrying about working women, creating free concerts for people in Washington. So that's the choice she makes. And then the third woman, Ida Tarbell, who becomes the most famous journalist of her era, prays at the age of 14 that she'll never take a husband, knowing that her mother had been unable to carry out her desires for higher education because of the family. So it's so interesting now to look back from our perspective. We have so many more choices today than these women each felt they had to choose in their own way, depending upon their desires. And I think the women are critical to these men. I mean, not simply as first ladies, but as their partners, and they make confidence or they make problems for them, whatever it is. And maybe that is a female perspective. In the 19th century, when men wrote about presidents, they would hardly mention the wives as if they were just a Mrs. Polk or something.
But I think that we do learn, I mean, if you're into history at all and understanding presidents, behind every president there is a powerful, powerful woman, wouldn't you say? I mean, that's
without
rare
question.
That there isn't. Yeah, and I can't wait for you one day to write a book about the next woman president.
Me too. It has to happen.
I think we're close. I do. But this book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age, why that this book now? And when I was doing research, you took 7 years to write this, but you didn't know it was going to go in the avenue that it went when you started. Is that true?
No, that's correct. Usually the first choice I make is the person that I want to spend so much time with, because my books take so long, and it took me twice as long to write about Franklin and Eleanor than it took the war to be fought, or not twice, almost twice as long for the Civil War, and 7 years for this. So Theodore Roosevelt was the person I wanted to spend my time with. But of course, there's so many good biographies on him, as there had been on FDR and on Lincoln, so I needed my own way into the story. And when I found out that Taft had been not just his successor and not just the man that ran against him in 1912, but a great friend, so that there was an emotional undertone to the breakup in their friendship, I started reading the letters between Teddy and Taft, 400 letters, really showing how close they had been. And then when I started to understand why it was that they had been one successful, Teddy, Taft falling short as president, it was because Taft did not understand the bully pulpit, did not understand how to deal with the press, at which Teddy was a genius. So that's how I got into the press and the Muckrakers and McClure. So it really became a three-sided story, but it's spreading out the cast of characters, and each one represents a different piece of this progressive era, which is the texture of the times I was writing about.
You know, this is interesting to me because, I mean, we all, Teddy Roosevelt, I mean, iconic, but William Howard Taft, who is he, right?
Right.
He's been lost in history. And really, when you look at it, that whole relationship that you so brilliantly recreate in the book is really tantamount to everything that we are today. Why is he so not followed or not been written about?
You know, I think it just happens that some presidents so shadow the others, that Teddy was such a, you know, many-sided figure. He was so popular in his time, so interesting for people with all of his different interests, you know, whether it's wild game hunting or observing birds or writing 40 books and being able to capture slogans that we still think about, the square deal, speak softly and carry a big stick. And Taft, as a more judicial, deliberative figure, really did carry out much of Roosevelt's legacy and had some substantial accomplishments as president, but never understood how to be a public figure, never really loved politics. I think the presidents we remember have to be people for whom politics is in their blood. And Taft would have been happy being a judge all his life and eventually does become Supreme Court Chief Justice and ends his life at the very place where he had wished he'd been all along. But he deserves more treatment because he's a really interesting fellow. And Teddy would say of Taft, he envied his personality because everybody loved Taft at first sight. He was very amiable, kind, gentle, and worked hard and did a good job at everything he did until he got to the presidency, and then sort of left on his own, he felt like a fish out of water.
You are listening to the Helly Kasser Chain Show, the podcast always available online at HellyKasserChain.com.
So this bromance that these two guys had ended not well. Why?
Because what happened is that Teddy was certain that Taft would carry out his legacy and actually handpicked him as his successor, ran his campaign for him, you know, told him to stop playing golf because golf looked like a rich man's game to the working class in the middle of the campaign, was so happy when he won, then went off to Africa for a year to give Taft space, comes back, and the progressive wing of the party was already beginning to move further away from the conservative wing, and they felt that Taft had fallen short, that he hadn't followed through on the things that Teddy wanted him to. It was more complicated than that. Taft's wife, who had been his great partner, had a devastating stroke 2 months into the presidency, and she could never speak again in connected sentences, so he spent so much of his time with her, and he did let things pass and get through with too much compromise in the Congress. Teddy comes back, the progressives say, you've got to take up our banner. And I think he also wanted to be back in public life. He missed it so. So he ends up running against Taft for the nomination in 1912, splitting the Republican Party. Really brutal campaign. I mean, they call each other names, and the progressives feel like the conservatives are destroying the country. The conservatives feel the progressives are doing the same. And of course, by the two of them running against each other, when Teddy finally bolts and forms a third party, they both lose. And the Democrat Woodrow Wilson wins.
The golden age of journalism. I love it. Muckraking. Sam McClure and McClure Magazine. So different than what we have today. And I think that is why this book really is such a time. I mean, you lucked out on this one. I mean, this is so timely. It's amazing to me.
Take long enough, something comes around that cycles back.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's phenomenal. But journalism is a bit tarnished these days, don't you think?
Well, I think what these people had, and that's why they remembered it later in their life, I'd
H.R. Bell and Ray Baker and William Allen White and Lincoln Steffens remembered this as the golden age of their own lives, because at this magazine where they all worked together, they were given 2 years to research their subjects. They were given expense accounts that were incredibly generous before they had to write a single word, which meant that when they came out with their 20 or 30,000 word pieces that would then be serialized 1 month after the other for an entire year, they made an impact on the public mind without a question. Ida Standard Oil was probably responsible, her expose, for breaking up Standard Oil. Ray Baker's columns and articles on the railroad helped to produce railroad regulation. And these articles still stand up today because they were factually based and they were so well researched. Where would we find somebody to support reporters doing that today? And the attention span is diminished and reporters are caught in 1,000 different ways. They're on Facebook or blogging and writing. Would people read 50,000 word articles today? It's a harder time, I think, even if there are reporters who want that mission call that these guys had, to wonder whether they really would be able to do it or the country would respond. But I suspect that desire is still there on young journalists coming out of journalism school, so there'll always be remnants of it somewhere.
That's good to know. The bully pulpit, Roosevelt was great at coining phrases. You brought one up before the square deal, but the bully pulpit, and tell me, is it what it once was in your opinion?
You know, I don't think it has the strength that it did, because in Roosevelt's time, if he gave a speech, it would be reported in full in the newspapers. Headlines would be talking about the way he had sloganized that speech, and then he could go around the country on train tours and talk again and again and repeat it. So it would finally get into the public mind. By the time of the radio, FDR's fireside chats were listened to by 80% of the adult radio audiences in whole. You weren't hearing just a part of them. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night, not miss a word of what he was saying because everybody was listening. Even in the early days of television, up till Reagan maybe, from JFK to Reagan, when there's only three networks, you're watching the whole president's speech. Now you might be watching your favorite cable network. You'll hear the pundits criticizing it before it stops. Breaking news comes in before we've even begun to concentrate on whatever they were talking about. And as I said, our attention span is diminished. So it's still there. The president still has a platform that no other leader has, but lots of other people have platforms, bully pulpits now too, bloggers and, you know, Twitterers, so he's competing against a much more loud audience.
Oh, the noise. Oh, the noise. Secretary of State Kerry said something that I wanted to ask you about. He said that it's the end of the era of the Monroe Doctrine is over, something that really Roosevelt was so much a part of. Talk to me about that. Do you agree with him?
I don't know. Tell me what he meant by that, because I'm not sure I do know what he would have meant by
well,
that.
Well, I guess what he's trying to say is that, you know, we're not going into other countries the way that we used to promote ourselves and our way of thinking. And I think it was applicable to what's going on in the Middle East at this point.
Right, right. And maybe it's just, you know, a cautionary tale that we've had such difficult experience when we've tried to promote democracy in these other countries, that he's just being honest about the fact that one has to be careful. And we've seen such experiences with Iraq and Afghanistan that it's made us more limited, perhaps, in our dreams of what's possible. That may be true. And the public doesn't seem to be willing to accept anymore, you know, these adventures in the world, causing treasures of our own lives here, unless we can be sure that it's changing the cultures abroad, which seems very hard to do.
But that was initially something that Teddy Roosevelt was a proponent of,
oh, without
of, correct?
A question. I mean, Teddy's in that era of imperialism, you know, where they really believe not only in America's democracy abroad, but America having a responsibility to civilize these other countries. And it's a part of him that, I mean, I wasn't writing that much about it because of the domestic focus is the center of the book, although the Philippines is definitely what is partly at issue. And even then, I think there's rightful criticism about whether after that Spanish-American War, we should have taken over, you know, the Philippines and become a colonial power, in essence. It's still a kind of argument that's a very real argument.
You're an historian. What would you take from your own book that is applicable to our politics today? It seems to me people are listening to Congress baseball games and sportscasters and reading newspapers and listening to presidents. And those that are interested in politics only seem to hear what they want to hear. So what's your thought?
I think that's what's really scary, that, you know, unless we can agree on the facts themselves, then there's no way we can debate the remedies. And right now, it's possible that people don't even agree on what is going on, much less, you know, what the remedies are.
What do you think? How do you see things? Do you think this country is doomed, or do you think that we will get it together?
No, I'll tell
Please
you, you know,
tell
one
me.
Of the, I promise. One of the... I think the solaces that history provides is that I remember Roosevelt, FDR, gave a speech in 1942 when everything seemed so low in terms of the Pearl Harbor losses in the Pacific. You know, when he reminded his countrymen that we went through these kind of valleys before, that George Washington was running out of supplies. It looked like the revolution was lost, but he persevered. The pioneers got over the Rocky Mountains. The early days of the Civil War looked bad for the Union. And he said, you know, there'll always be these moments of time, but there's something about this country founded on an idea more than any other country that somehow will come through. And it does look really hard now, the political culture in Washington. I think it's as bad as it's been in 50 years, but something will break through. It feels like the country's so frustrated with it now, but in the end, it's the country that's going to have to respond. That's what McClure said. In the end, there's none left but all of us. And maybe that's true. We have to redistrict those districts so that there's room for moderation, maybe change the primary system, do something about campaign finance, which I still think is the poison in the system. But these can all be done. As FDR once said, problems are made by men. They can be solved by men.
I said to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was on the show, that now when you run for office, you run against your opponent and also Mr. Citizens United.
Absolutely. Like,
it's,
I still think right? a constitutional amendment to remedy that situation is key. And that's where some
Absolutely.
Groups out there have to really mobilize to get that done. Until that's done, there's probably little chance of our politicians not being indebted to the people that are funding them. It's inevitable. That's who they spend their time with. They spend so much of their time raising money. It's just nuts.
It is nuts, absolutely. Doris Kearns Goodwin once said that once a president gets to the White House, the only audience that is left that really matters is history. I wonder if President Obama walks around with his fingers crossed, his history yet to be written, perhaps by Doris Kearns Goodwin, the author. Doris Kearns Goodwin, the book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Old Golden Age of Journalism, published by Simon & Schuster. Doris, are the Yankees going to get back in the front run?
Inevitably. But this is such a happy year that right now I feel generous. We'll see how I feel if we're battling each other next year.
We'll talk about that when your next book comes out. It's been a pleasure having you on the Helen Kester James Show.
Thank you so much. I'll
thank you so much.
Locker room.
I'll think of you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.